My name is Kurt Anderson, and I chair the Science and Technology Committee, and I believe the title of this session is Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. And what we thought we would do is just begin by giving a little bit of history on some of the parts of the village, if you will, that we deal with as a Science and Technology Committee. And two of those areas, one is the hydroelectric system, and the other is garbology or recycling and how we handle our waste here. And I'd like to, when we get to that point, to introduce a couple of people that will be going over that history. And what we thought we'd do is spend maybe 15 or 20 minutes just giving some background and history into a few areas, and then really spend the majority of our time opening it up for discussion and questions from all of you. Prior to that, just a little bit of information about the Science and Technology Committee. We're a very open committee that the members are people who have shown interest in some of the challenges that the physical elements of the village provide us, keeping the hydroelectric running, the water treatment system, the sewage system, just all the physical aspects of the village. And we act as a voluntary advisory group to the directors of the village. And we meet twice a year, usually once here in the village during the summer and once at PLU. And if any of you would like additional information, contact any one of the Science and Technology Committee members, which are sitting around here. And if you'd like to get on the list to get correspondence, please let one of us know. With that, I'd like to introduce Terry Saturn, and Terry is going to talk a little bit about the hydro.
Thank you, Terry. For those of you who don't know, there's a little building about a quarter of the size of this room and about half as high. Down the road, across the footbridge, and about 100 feet up the trail, through which 27,719 pounds of water a minute flows. And that turns a 2,400 pound magnet at 600 revolutions per minute. And that allows me to read this. And it allows you to take hot showers and a hot jacuzzi and have hot food on the table. And to have lights in your rooms. This is the Holden Power Plant. When Holden Village was donated to the Lutheran Church, by House Sound Mining Company, one of the initial concerns was how to acquire electricity. The House Sound Mining Company purchased power from the Chelan Public Utility District and ran a 212,000 volt high line up the north shore of Lake Chelan, and then it crossed over to Domkey Mountain. And then from the top of Domkey Mountain, crossed over the Railroad Creek Valley, and then the lines ran up the valley to the upper level of the mine, and there was a transformer substation up there. And that's how they got their electricity. However, when the mine closed down, the lines were deactivated and the substation was taken out, was salvaged. So the guiding people behind Holden Village had to concern themselves with how to provide electricity up here for this operation that we enjoy today. In 1960, the consensus of the committee provided for three options. And Number one was to reactivate the High Line coming up Lake Chelan and to buy power from the Public Utility District. Number two was to generate electricity with diesel generators. And number three was to install a hydroelectric plant. Over the next 2 years, a very dedicated committee comprised of 11 volunteers researched the many options, following up leads on a lot of power plants used and new throughout the western states. Hydropower became the most feasible of the three options. Several sources of water for generating the electricity were investigated, and those included Railroad Creek, Termite Creek, Big Creek, 10 Mile Creek, and Copper Creek. The conclusion was to utilize Copper Creek, which is right up here, for a high pressure, low volume system. And Copper Creek seemed to provide an adequate amount of water year-round for a hydroelectric plant. Since freezing weather during the winter reduces the amount of water that's available, this was of critical concern regarding the location of the plant and the source of the water. The committee considered many sizes and types of power plants. One option was taking a 125 horsepower motor from a vault down by Railroad Creek, which the mine used to power a pump as an emergency backup system for pumping water for domestic use within the village. Taking this 125 horsepower motor, putting a turbine on it, and spinning that and providing electricity, which would have provided about 30 kilowatts of power. And all the way from that to a 350 kilowatt generator, which they had located somewhere in the western states. But they came across two generators that were used by the Lewiston Orchard Water District. And these were eventually secured, and they were one General Electric generator with a patent date of December 2nd, 1902, and with a 300 kilowatt maximum capacity, and one Westinghouse generator with a patent date August 29th, 1916, with a 200 kilowatt capacity. They secured these for one of them was $900 and the other was $350. And that included the Pelton wheels, the turbines, a lot of the controls, a lot of valves, the exciter generators, at least one exciter generator, and one governor. By August 1st, 1963, the water rights had been secured from the state of Washington to divert up to 6 cubic feet/second of water from Copper Creek by a diversion dam, 634 vertical feet above the proposed hydroelectric plant site. which is right down here. Once the permits were in hand, work started immediately that August 1963 on the powerhouse. Some 40,000 pounds of equipment was shipped up Lake Chelan on a barge, and with the assistance of a Swiss logging operation here in the valley that was working at the time, the equipment was hauled up here to the site. The powerhouse footings were poured and the building was framed by October 24th, 1963, with the generators and turbines enclosed before the snow halted any further progress on November 1st of that year. The Holden Village Power Plant was placed into service on August 6, 1994, utilizing water from the domestic diversion dam used during the mining days. And then for the next 2 years, with work from a lot of volunteers and minimal scrounged equipment, work continued on the upper dam, which was 200 feet higher than the existing diversion dam. And this new dam consisted of a diversion dam and a settling box to settle out the sediment from the creek and a flume. And all of the footings for those various component parts. All of the cement was mixed by hand in a large mixer, but small for the scale of the project. We mixed all of the gravel and sand and cement and on a hill above the dam site, and then built some flumes and dumped the cement down into the forms down below. We completed pouring that as the snow was flying by October of 1965. The summer of 1966 focused on getting the settling box in place up there and laying 3,000 feet of 14-inch pipe, steel pipe, from the hydro plant up to the dam site, the settling box. The pipe was hauled up Lake Chelan on the barge, and from Lake Chelan up to the upper level of the mine on a logging truck, and from there up piece by piece up the hill on an old Army surplus bomb loader. On August 11, 1966, the water supply to the hydro plant was switched to the new dam, and this increased the water pressure from about 160 pounds per square inch to about 282 pounds per square inch, which is now the existing operating pressure. So that's kind of the background of how that plant happened and the amount of time that it took to do it. Those are the early years. Since that time, a lot of work has been done refining the distribution of the power primarily throughout the village. And there have been a lot of efficiencies taken in controlling the load within the village itself. And there's been ongoing maintenance of the plant, but for the most part, it's done remarkably well and produces, how much, James?
Per year?
Yeah. Million kilowatt hours?
Sure. Well, thanks, Jerry. From there, perhaps we'll go to a little different topic, and that's not one that is very visible to most of you through the village, and that's what we do with all of the waste that are generated, food waste and other waste. And I'd like to introduce Cheryl Chang and go into some of the history of that and how that's being handled by the village.
Thanks, Kurt. Well, in marked contrast to all the data that Terry has, we have relatively little data about early solid waste practices here at the village, maybe because garbage men don't keep very good records. But we can be fairly confident that there were a number of dumps, as opposed to landfills, on the village site at various times during its history. I do know that in 1979, a small incinerator was donated to the village, so at least since that time, we've been burning a portion of our waste. Incineration is usually something that's pretty controversial. What's very striking is that it's a vital part of our solid waste program here, because it allows us to get rid of things that would be very expensive to haul just because of their volume. And by that I mean basically paper items that are contaminated or the wrong kind of paper, so it's not recyclable. Things like paper towels and napkins and that sort of thing. And so we do burn those in the incinerator. And it does take diesel fuel to fire that. And I guess the lesson there is that we're making a compromise. We prefer not to use fossil fuel, but in order to burn things cleanly, we have to do that. We have had landfills on the site. We do know that there's a landfill that we closed a few years ago, about 3 years ago, and it had non-degradable things like mattresses and overstuffed furniture and apparently an attic full of manual typewriters. Broken pottery and that sort of thing. And if you went out, is it tailings number two? There's a small sign out there. It's an area, it's maybe three times the size of this fire pit. It's sloped on the top so the water runs off of it, and it's got a crop of grass on it now. We've put compost on it, and so we're keeping the rainwater off of it through the grasses and that sort of thing. And we have gone through the permitting process with the health district on that. We all know that there's a lot of sorting of waste here. I suspect that in Washington State, Holden Village's waste is probably more sorted and picked over than any other waste in the state. When I heard the theme yesterday, today, and tomorrow, I thought, oh, it's they served it yesterday, we had it again today, and tomorrow it's going up the hill to the mountain. And in a sense, the whole program helps keep us conscious of what we're doing. Those of you who have had to have garbology duty understand the concept of servanthood firsthand, because it's not a particularly pleasant task, and yet it's extremely vital, because what we don't send out on a barge as a recyclable material, which we hope we get some income for, like cardboard or glass or steel or aluminum cans, everything else has to go to a landfill, for which we pay not only for the barge service, but of course, the disposal fee. So it's important, we all recognize here, but having to do those little acts of sorting our own waste is a conscious reminder of that sort of thing and where we fit in the whole ecological cycle, if you will. The food waste composting has progressed from, I think the late 70s, early 80s, we experimented with vermiculture, worm boxes. I believe those compost bins were designed by Russ Wold sometime in the early 80s. And this year we have four new compost bins to increase our capacity because of the amount of food waste generated in the summer months. I just learned that the health department basically allows us to, well, anything that's gone out to your table has to be discarded if it's not eaten. And anything that's been through the, if it's in the kitchen and it's not actually
cooked twice,
it's discarded as a health rule. So we're forced in a way, because of the safety elements of food handling, to dispose of maybe more than we would if it were in our own homes. So we do generate a lot of food compost. We all know that it goes bad pretty quickly. We have a disposal problem in terms of creatures great and small wanting to get a share of it, and that's why you may notice electric fences up at the compost bins. A few years ago, we had a project that was really quite successful. We had an intern for a week. She came up here and constructed an aeration system. Food waste composting is a lot more difficult to achieve than composting yard waste. A lot of you probably have backyard composters for grass and leaves, and even then, you know, sometimes the grass goes bad on you. Food waste goes bad almost instantly, and we need to push air through those bins to keep the process aerobic. And there's still some odor generated, as you probably know if you've been up there. But the quality of the compost has really improved since we've had installed that blower in the aeration system. And I don't know if you've seen the compost used in some of the flower beds here, and certainly up on the landfill and on the vegetation islands up there on the tailings. So I think there's a real constructive process going on there, and it does keep visible to us the requirements and how much work it is to really live to live green. One short sales pitch. If we think about it, what we have here is really a small city. I mean, the population is some 400 people in the summer. And we really have a fairly complicated solid waste system. We have recycling, we have incineration, we have a landfill to maintain, and all the logistics associated with it. And I think one of the things we see in future years is that becoming a more important position for a person who wants to be a solid waste manager in training. So something to think about anyway.
Thanks, Gerald. I think one of the most visible, we were trying to pick out when we were selecting a few topics, and there are many to talk about. We were trying to pick out some of the topics that were perhaps most visible or were current projects going on. And certainly, I think one of the most visible to the eye here is the tailings. And Martin Wells is going to give a little bit of history on the tailings and a little bit of background on where the tailings stand now.
I report this to you just because there are some breakthroughs in the last year that are very important and exciting in terms of the eventual restoration of the valley from the mine damage, which is now since its beginning in 1937. The complete report by scientists who are presently working on the tailings to get a complete scientific picture of the characteristics of the tailings and what the water and air and other elements are doing up there is available in our tape library under, I think, the title Dames and Moore Forum. Dames and Moore is a consulting firm working on the project right now, and they had a forum for us in the spring after spending 6 weeks here, about a dozen scientists doing various kinds of studies up there. So the big pusher these days is that the Forest Service recognized that there was some significant health danger associated with the blowing tailings and the air pollution that caused, and the fact that added to the pollutants in the river. The river is essentially unable to support fish culture about 6 miles down valley. After about the 6 mile marker, we know there are fish able to live in the river. So it's not a completely dead river, but it's the goal of the Forest Service and other agencies to restore the river to a good fish culture. And that goes also then to the issue of fish in Lake Chelan. The other issue there is protection of Lake Chelan. As you heard on the boat coming up, it's a pristine lake. One of the deep and beautiful non-polluted lakes in the United States, and there's a good deal of interest in protecting that. What they want to protect it from is the tailings having a dramatic effect on the water quality down there. So the Forest Service has been interested in protecting the people who are here from wind-blown pollutants, protecting the lake from a catastrophic collapse of the tailings pile and any chance that those tailings would end up down in the lake, and also restoring the river so that it supports fish life. To that end, in about 1987 and 88, they paid about $4 million of Exxon Valdez penalty monies to support the capping of the tailings with gravel. As I understand it, the goal of the capping was to restore a living habitat which would store water at the surface for seedlings and also provide those seedlings with protection from the wind, which is fairly constant up there, and also then to keep the wind blow of the pollutants down. While they were doing that, they also installed drains, and if you're up above in Copper Basin, it's very clear where those drains cut across the tailings now to drain standing water off the tailings. One of the issues was if the tailings were saturated with moisture, either by flood or heavy rain or standing water, and you got an earthquake, would there be a liquefaction effect and those tailings collapse and move? So I think that was their interest in keeping the water off the top of the tailings. So they put these drains across. The other thing they did was put the big rocks along the river, riprap, in order to stop the river from cutting into the base of the tailings along the river and carrying those pollutants downriver. They knew from water measurements above the village and at the village and below the village that there was some water missing, and they suspected that there was an original channel to the river which might be still actively carrying water. And I think the geophysical work that they've done this summer has established that down at Tailings Pile 3, the original course of the river cuts rather dramatic towards the mountainside, towards the south, and that in fact that water still is running underneath the tailings. The sort of bubbling, gaseous, Yellowstone looking like yucky material at the very base of the tailings where it rejoins the forest floor is probably generated in part because there's water coming under the tailings and surfacing in some way there. So that money was spent by the Forest Service to address those issues, and the Forest Service has no money of its own, nor does the Superfund legislation carry any money with it. As I understand, it's never been funded by Congress. It's intended to be funded, any remedial work is intended to be funded by insurance proceeds from other lawsuits. That's how we ended up with the Exxon Valdez money in the first place to work here. The Forest Service would like to take that $4 million and move on down the road to their next process, their next task. So they have initiated negotiations and finally up to constructing but not filing a lawsuit against the successor to the Howe Sound Mining Corporation, which is a corporation called Alumet. And they are now what we call under the Superfund legislation the potentially responsible party. They are the defendant in an action which the government is prepared to take against them to recover that money. It all gets kind of complicated in here, and if the scientists and guys who work in this field know better than I do, please pipe in. But as I understand it, the Washington Department of Ecology, that also has some jurisdiction in the area, has withheld its participation in that action against Alumet, believing that if such an important lawsuit was going to be filed at this point, this is the moment to do the global restoration work on the entire tailings issue in the valley. And so they have pushed this whole process past a $4.5 million lawsuit over some gravel into the realm of who knows what regarding what I've come to understand is about 100 million cubic yards of tailings, 80 acres on the surface of tailings in the valley. So Alumet has stepped forward and hired Dames and Moore to come up and finish the picture of the scientific realities associated with the tailings and to begin the process of proposing the remedial actions that would be necessary in order to restore the valley to wholeness and get us on the way towards that part of Holden's mission, which has always been dear to us, which is the eventual reforestation of the valley. So it's an exciting time. This winter there will be proposals surfaced for what will happen, what should happen in order to take care of the tailings. We don't know what those proposals are yet, but we'll have a chance to look at those through the winter. Next spring, early, there will be a public comment phase in which Holden will have an opportunity to press its case for what it thinks ought to happen there, as well as some other public land trustees who will be invited in to comment on what should happen there. So stay tuned. It's an exciting moment for those of us who've been around Holden for a long time and dreamt of the day when remediation and restoration would happen for the whole valley.
Thanks, Martin. Well, at this point, you know, we've just covered three physical issues that the village deals with on a daily basis. We thought we'd hold it to that and open it up to all of you to ask any questions or talk about anything that you might be interested in at this point. So we have a number of people from the committee here, and we'll attempt to answer any questions you might have.
This is an issue that's, for which this is not probably the proper forum, and more of like an architectural issue, but what is the future concerns of accessibility for handicap? And if this is not the proper forum, then we'll talk it other ways, because we have a good friend who was there in the younger years and had suffered the trauma of polio and would like to come back here, and I imagine others like that who may be totally wheelchair situation, and what would be the feasibility here in terms of the future about accessibility and what's planned? Is that appropriate item for this?
Sure.
You want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Mark Schmidt. I'm the operations manager at the village, so I live here year-round with the staff that takes care of the physical plant of this village. And I can answer that briefly, and it's probably not completely as you'd like. We do have plans towards making several of the buildings more accessible. If you walk down the road today and look at the north end of Lodge 1, you'll see them rebuilding a porch. It's being rebuilt for a couple of different reasons. One, because the old porch, very worn by the weather, and it's falling down. It just needs to be replaced. But the reason for the new footings and the reason that the new porch will be much wider is so that there will be a safe emergency exit ramp out the back end that complies with the ADA. In many of the remodeling projects that we're doing, we're trying to the extent possible in this location to make those things accessible. It'll always be a little bit of a challenge to get people in and out on buses, for instance.
Yeah, definitely.
But to the extent that some of these buildings, Lodge 4 was done several years ago, so that might be closer to the ADA. It's not perfect. American with Disabilities Act, the specifications required there. And of course, you know about the Hike House. That's one of the most recent attempts to make this whole wilderness area more accessible to all that want to come here and enjoy it. And that was done as a partnership between Holden Village and the Forest Service. We have a good connection with those folks. They provided a lot of money that made possible that remodel and also the trail out to 10 Mile. So the attempt is there. It's probably perhaps slower in coming than some would like, but our intent is there to eventually put a much better entrance into the dining hall, for instance, so that from the arc it will be much easier for folks to get into the dining hall. Chipping away at it. But we have ideas. Well, when we undergo a remodel, we take care of it. We don't have a formal document that outlines exact changes and dates.
Yeah, it's just sort of visualizing it. It's the boat and the bus seem to be a bigger problem than the immediate area around the dining hall.
And we try to the extent that we can, we try to accommodate. Every once in a while, I'll take a van instead of a bus down to the lake, because sometimes it's easier to lift someone up the short distance into the back of a van than it is up into a bus if they really need to stay in their chair. It's a less than perfect system, but we try to accommodate as best we can, send extra people and help as best we can. So.
Does the Holden wish list include a van with a lift?
No, but it sure could, Carol. Thank you.
What's the life expectancy on the generators that we have here now? And have you looked forward to to when that might need attention?
I don't know if Carl is here. Should I?
Yeah.
Thanks, Dwayne. We're actually in the process of assessing that more carefully. That question's been asked several times in the last couple of years. And in the coming months, next month to be more specific, we're going to have a professional inspection, a professional hydro and Pelton wheel engineer come and inspect our units, looking for two things. One, gross inefficiencies, if there are ways we might get more electric power out of our generator year-round. But just, and maybe more importantly, the maintenance needs. Help us, a very trained eye, help us assess the ongoing maintenance needs and the potential risks if we don't meet those maintenance needs of those generators and the turbines. So we're all very aware it needs to be done. I'm all very excited that it's going to happen soon and that we can start some longer term, let's take care of our hydro planning very soon.
Given adequate water flow, you do get enough electrical power out of those generators now?
When?
Given adequate water flow? Yes,
in the summer, typically they provide abundantly. In the winter, we need to make other accommodations, and we do several different things. We reduce the electric load outright. We shut down many of the buildings. We alter the way that we heat those buildings that we keep open year-round. Most of the buildings that are here year-round are heated two different ways. One, electrically, so that when the hydro produces abundantly, we can use that free, clean, non-polluting power. But then when it doesn't produce enough, we either fire wood furnaces, or in a couple situations, oil furnaces, so that we might heat those buildings. So we shed the load. We play funny games. If you lived here year-round, you would know in the middle of winter, you'd be hard-pressed to get a shower at 4 in the afternoon in your chalet because our hot water tanks are only on in the middle of the night when no one else is using the power, and timers turn them off all day so that the power may be used elsewhere, such as in our kitchen to cook our food. So we play all kinds of power management games in the winter to make up for the fact that the supply is more scarce.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dwayne.
Along that line, I'm Bill Giddings, member of the committee. Along that line, we should mention that the remodeling projects are to enable us to get much better use out of what we have. And the Chalet 7 remodel, the committee's been told, now uses 30% of the heat required before it was completely rebuilt, insulated, and designed for energy efficiency. So ultimately, if all of the buildings were brought to that standard, it might indeed be that the present hydro output would be adequate without use of wood and oil on a regular basis.
I guess my questions are in terms of safety issues. I wonder if does the committee concern itself, for example, the pollution, the air pollution, air quality issue throughout the year, both to guests and to long-term staff people. Is this an issue that is addressed by the committee? What effects this might have? Happen to live in Tacoma right now, and we're going through the end result of a process of a lawsuit against ASARCO, where pollutants were distributed throughout neighborhoods, and even invited, you know, to studies to go. Have my blood tested to see if there's an arsenic content within that. I'm not so worried myself, but of course the children who lived in that area, that's another story. At least I would be concerned. So I guess I'm just asking the question, you know, is this the kind of issue, and if so, what have y'all found in terms of air quality? And then one other little, which is even a more far out kind of issue, the addressing of the mine in terms of dangers that it might pose to the village. in terms of the, I remember being on the board and hearing something just sort of off the side one time about a concern in terms of water levels within certain, you know, shafts of the mine, and what it would mean, what would happen if an earthquake or something. This is all far out, but I guess I'm just concerned about the safety issues. Is this something that the committee, and maybe you could even address those issues if nothing else but briefly?
Yeah, well, I can start out and answer that generally, and then maybe if I can, I'll turn it over to Martin, since Martin is in primary contact with the people that are, James Moore and others, that are doing the actual sampling. But in general response to the question on what we discussed in the committee, yes, we do discuss health and safety questions, and just from the physical nature of the village itself, and discuss potential solutions. Some issues require a lot of data gathering to answer, and our ability to gather some of that data we can handle ourselves or with the help of other volunteers that assist the village. A couple of examples of that might be we were looking at water quality in the pipes, knowing that the pipes here are old, and Dean's probably with his daughter right now, but he was a chemistry professor at PLU, and he took a number of samples throughout the village from different outlets and compared those, took them back to PLU and did analysis and compared those. Well, his results in short were that the water here was there was actually no metals, virtually no metals in the drinking water, and it was a lot better than what they were drinking at PLU in the chemistry department. So that the capability of doing that existed with one of the volunteers that volunteers their time and efforts for the village. Some of the questions regarding the mine are much more complex questions and ones that take a tremendous amount of energy and cost to answer. And maybe
actually, I could add something, Kurt, in regards to the tailings themselves and the dust generated and what health safety issues are. The village has been partnering in the past with the Forest Service in gathering data, air quality data. I don't know the exact date that sampling partnership quit, but there
was 94.
So there was, so 3 years ago, and there was, I guess, several rounds of sampling that had been going on that we were working in partnership with the Forest Service in getting. So, as Kurt said, this committee has the capabilities to get involved in those types of things, especially more so for the future. In that particular instance, that was generated by village contacts themselves outside of the committee. As an aside, I couldn't help but hear that you're near the Arsarco thing, and I don't know if you'd like to know this or not, but major portion of what went through Arsarco came from this place.
Yes.
So there's a connection there.
Yes, sir.
That I hope it's not to a place.
I think what we'll find is that the summaries of the air quality studies done both before, during, and after the capping work will be available as part of the complete technical package that comes out in the report as they look at the need to do something about the tailings. So I think this winter we'll probably see that information. The monitoring station was up at the top of Chalet Hill, and one of our villagers got $10 a month or something for reading it every day, and that information is being gathered, and we know something about it. There's been some concern every once in a while expressed about what is the consistency of the dirt down by Narnia, since it's a school. And as far as I know, that will also come out in this scientific package whether that's tailings and any problem or not, but there's been no real red flags waved in front of us about any of these issues so far. So far as the mine issues, you're right, Holly, at one point we did have something of a concern that the water flow out of the portal ought to be assured somehow, because that was a sign that water pressure was probably not building up within the shafts of the mine. And my guess is that's all part of what's coming up too, is there have been various suggestions as to how to forestall that possibility of a buildup of pressure back in there. And we're going to probably have to address that now. So far as the mine site itself, it's still, no one's really tackled that one head on yet, other than to try and recycle as much of the metal, as we could. The reason the mill stands as it does today is because the company that was hired by Holden in its fairly early days to recycle that metal went broke trying to take it apart. It was so heavily built. Some of those girders up there are twisted because their last intervention of choice was to try and blow it down, and they couldn't even do that.
One question you raised early on about the air quality and health is one of the driving forces behind our committee working toward reducing as much as possible the use of wood, because wood smoke is indeed a health hazard, as well as the process of obtaining the wood is probably the most hazardous occupation that village volunteers are taking part in. And so that's another reason driving toward weatherization as the number one objective in improving our energy situation.
You talked about the water. Do you have to do any treatment to it at all then? You're saying it's pretty pure. So is that,
there are surface water. When you use surface water for drinking water, there are regulations. And someone want to tackle the surface water treatment?
The process that we have right now is just a simple settling box of where the water comes into the pipe to settle out big, large things like rocks, sticks, silt, stuff like that. And then when the water enters our system, it gets injected with some chlorine to kill biological stuff like Giardia, bacteria, stuff like that. And that's all it is right now. It's just a little bit of chlorine and no real filters. But I don't know what the date is. It's like October or something. The end of this summer, we're supposed to have in place a filtration plant, which is part of the whole new garage project. One corner of that building is designated for a water filtration plant that will involve a sand pre-filter and a setup of parallel Giardia bag type filters to filter out Giardia or other bacteria. And it will also continue to get chlorinated, but at lower levels because of the filtration.
Holden is regulated by the same set of rules that regulate every other water system, sewer system, municipality. And I think our location has somewhat guarded us from being over-regulated, but part of the committee's role has been to keep us on the high road with all those regulations, and treatment is, and filtration is, a required feature of surface water.
Is liquid sewage any problem, technological problem, or is that an easy one to deal with?
James!
It's fun to deal. it's sort of a problem, yeah. We have a gravity feed system that goes down to a septic tank that's by Narnia there, which you might have smelled. And the septic tank is just basically a big three-chambered box too that settles out big stuff. And at the third chamber, hopefully what goes into there is just liquid effluent, which then gets pumped a quarter of a mile out to the old miner's village or Winston camp. And out there is a set of four drain fields that the liquid effluent goes into and is supposed to be treated out there naturally in the ground. But we've had some problems with that system in the past, not working up to its design capacity.
Is that the original system or the one that you built? Or?
Mm-hmm. It's, yeah, I don't know. It's put in about 1980s.
Oh, lady.
One of the other pieces that James was closely involved with, and one of the joys of living here long term, is every 2 years the tank has to be pumped out like your, any other residential tank would have to be. It's a little bit more of a production for us because of our remote location, but a 2,000-gallon septic trunk will come up on the barge one afternoon and has to be back on the barge the next morning. And so from the time it comes in, they'll pump our 30,000-gallon tank empty and disperse that out on a far corner of the tailings where we have special permit by both the County Health Department and the Forest Service to do so. So unlike maybe the way you could do it at home where the truck just comes in and disappears, we take it out to the far reach of the tailings, including to a place where you can't drive, because you can't drive to the application site. There's a big 6-inch plastic pipe. It takes it about 150, 200 feet perhaps across the tailings, affectionately dubbed the poop chute. We drive the truck out there and empty it. This past time, we did almost 20 loads of that truck to get it empty, finishing at 4 or 5 in the morning so that it could be on the barge by 8 o'clock the next morning. So, yeah, a few challenges.
Probably one of the other ones that I'll talk to you about is that, particularly in the summertime when the village is populated at its, to its greatest level, the water consumption in the village is large enough that the drain fields aren't totally able to deal with all of the disposal. And part of what the committee is looking at is different solutions to that or ways to what may be going on. It is a continuing message here to minimize the use of water in the community in the summertime that goes into the sewage system. Largely because the disposal is so difficult. And it has been an issue in the committee for several years to look at different opportunities. The most difficult challenge is to do it without a large block of dollars. Dollars could probably fix it pretty readily, but any type of major investment opens the door to a lot of additional permitting activities and capital expenditures that the cash situation of the village has not been able to deal with all the other infrastructure needs. So a reminder that it is a very significant act on everyone's part to use as little water as they can that goes down the drain, because it starts showing up down Miner's Village out of the drain fields that can't get overloaded.
Anyone else? Well, it's about that time to break for Vespers, but thank you very much for all the interest. Yeah,
one can minute. I just say one, I really want to express thanks to each one of you that serve on this committee. I think this is such a wonderful thing that people are willing to help make our village continue. And I speak for myself, but I'm sure for many, many other people who don't know you and the quality of the work you do and your interest and service to Holden, I think it's just fantastic. And I just thank God for people like you and others who are willing to invest yourselves to make Holden continue as a gift into this next century here. I thank you. God's blessing upon you. Appreciate that.
Thank you.